Well, good afternoon once again, everyone, and welcome to Open Sources Guelph for another Thursday. My name is Scotty Hertz, back in the bunker for another week, broadcasting live through pipes and wires and you name it, just through space, time, satellites, and everything. And speaking of pipes and satellites and everything, Adam A. Donaldson, are you on the line?
I'm on the line.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful, wonderful. So, once again, we have connectivity, which is what it's all about these days. Oh, this
Yay,
contact.
Pipes.
What's that?
Yay, pipes.
Yay, pipes. This contactless everything, I'm telling you. I don't know. Today on the show, we have the usual four topics. Not the usual topics, but the usual set of four topics, including Amazon may be the first company in the world to have a trillionaire at its head. And there's lots going on at various Amazon locations across the world. We're going to talk a bit about that in the shadow of COVID-19. Also in the shadow of COVID-19, the state of journalism in the world, starting with the U.S., I guess, but also around the world. What's the story there with journalism and covering stories in these times? Also, we have a public inquiry for the Nova Scotia shooting. Is that going to be a possibility, or is it something that the government or governments are going to sit on for a time? We'll get into that. But off the top, our first topic is austerity in the pandemic and post-pandemic era. Is that something that we are going to see more of, less of, the same of? I don't know. What do you think, Adam?
Well, we should begin by saying this sort of comes off of a TVO piece from their website. John Michael McGrath wrote an opinion piece, "There's No Such Thing as Nonpartisan Recovering Plan, Deal With It." And basically, his suggestion was that I may be reading too much into what he wrote, but his argument was that the pandemic will have not changed the base instincts of Doug Ford and Justin Trudeau, and as soon as the immediate danger has passed, we'll get back to normal. And normal, of course, being what Doug Ford was doing pre-pandemic, which was trying to rein in spending, trying to stop new spending, having spending cuts in order to combat Ontario's deficit. And for Justin Trudeau, it was, by and large, a lot of lip service to different things that, ultimately he doesn't pay much in terms of actual physical dollars to, things like climate change, things like more transparency in parliament. And, I guess McGrath's argument was that literally things will go back to normal. And if, to talk specifically about Ontario, because Doug Ford has been enjoying quite the surge in popularity because of how he's handled the response, and understandably so. I mean, when you see other places like, let's say, Brazil, off the top of our heads, where mm-hmm. Bolsonaro is like doing push-ups to show how tough he is instead of, walking around in a mask. And speaking of masks, Donald Trump was just doing a tour of a ventilator factory in Michigan, not wearing a mask in flagrant violation of that state's rules. When Doug Ford, of all people, comes out and talks sensibly, it makes people forget that last fall, in the economic statement, the government says, oh, by the way, we've slashed the deficit to $7.4 billion after they, inflated the deficit to $15 billion because they used different math or something. And then they brought that down to, they predicted a deficit of $11.7 billion, and then it turns out there was $7.4 billion. And, in the meantime, there were all these announcements about cuts. We experienced that, of course, at CFRU, although that wasn't technically a government cut. It was just a general FU cut.
Yeah, but in a roundabout way, it was a government cut, sort of. Like in a backhanded way, which has now been repealed, at least for the time being. And then we became essential, right? We became essential under their rules as well. So,
right,
that's
and
why
that's
we're here.
It exactly, and so to have all these cuts, some of which end up reinstated or postponed or whatever, and to magically reduce the deficit in the meantime, it's hard not to think that once the crisis has passed, and with a new deficit of $21 billion, that we aren't going to see some of the same old Doug Ford come back and start talking about how we all have to tuck in and, you know, pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. I'm not sure if that all was what McGrath was getting at, but I added some stuff on my own.
Of course. That's how we roll. It's amazing how people think that Doug Ford is somehow a different individual magically because of the things that have happened. And I don't want to be that guy that just bashes on him because, you know, he is, I mean, I wouldn't say it pains me to say he's doing a good job. He's doing a really good job at reading the prompter and getting the points out that his party, I mean, it's very obviously not just him. Like it's a group effort, right? This is the difference between here and places like the U.S. with Trump and Brazil with Bolsonaro. We don't have a presidential system, so it is a team effort. You see, when Ford is speaking, Christine Elliott, who was like neck and neck with him for the leadership in the background, and yesterday actually Carol Mulroney made an appearance. So there it's not a solo effort. So Is Doug Ford doing a good job? He's doing a really good job at presenting the portfolio, let's say, as to how they're rolling. The problem is, or the challenge is, that the obsession with deficits, which existed well before this and will afterwards, I mean, it's not going to go away, right? There, the obsession with balancing a budget is inherent to not just this version of conservatives, but conservatives in general. That is how they roll in the year 2020 and have for years. So we can't excuse all those things that happened beforehand. A good example would be the discussions over e-learning, which to me is a form of austerity. I guess any teacher would tell you that too. It's like, okay, there's more online learning, there's less teachers. So there was the, okay, we're going to have four classes. No. Okay, well, you're going to have two classes online. No. Now it's everything, right? Every single thing is online now. So with that foot in the door, does anybody honestly think that that's going to be completely peeled away whenever the heck we go back to the way things were? I don't think so. Because they'll say, well, this course is working well, and this one's working well, so we won't go back. So this is the risk, or the potentially what's going to happen is, like, everything is going to become because of COVID. It's going to be, we've done this because of COVID and we keep doing it. It's also going to be, well, we can't, that's the big one, is going to be, we can't do that because of COVID. We're in the hole. We're $20 billion in the hole. We're $30 billion. We can't do this. We can't give you that raise. We can't hire more people. COVID, COVID, COVID. So in that way, it becomes sort of a roundabout excuse as to be able to cut. And that's the concern. So, I mean, right now we're seeing that standard Keynesian, like, throw money at things, stimulate things, keep people trucking for a period of time. And then it's a wait and see after that, right? We're sort of easing back into things, nowhere near where we were, obviously. This is what, phase one or level one or whatever the heck they're calling it?
Stage one.
phase one. Pier one. Is that gone? I don't know. So anyway.
It's almost gone,
I think. So this is the thing. Unless something, there's been some sort of miraculous change overnight, and I don't think that there has been, that we're definitely going to see austerity post-COVID, whenever the heck that is.
Well, you have to keep in mind, too, that, you know, one of the biggest stories provincially before this was the teacher strikes, which were ongoing and were kind of like showing no signs of resolution. And then COVID hits, and I think all sides agreed that, you know, whatever was going on or whatever politics they were trying to play, didn't matter in the age of COVID. Because before that, Stephen Lecce was pointedly coming out and saying, this is all about money, this is all about, seniority and all that. And you hear from the teachers' unions all the time saying, no, it's about job security, it's about classroom sizes, it's about having the right resources, it's about e-learning and losing those jobs to, you know, independent study courses and kids maybe not having the resources. And of course, that has been, that last part has been sort of thrown off the table now because the circumstances have forced e-learning onto kids across the province. And as of right now, we have no idea how much the kids are absorbing from that and whether or not it is effective even in the limited ways they were proposing with, I mean, for high school kids to take like 2 to 4 courses. You know, kids are going to be getting their report cards next month, and it's pretty much going to be like you pass, you fail. And there's definitely going to be that debate, as you said, that, you know, they're going to come out and say, like, look, COVID showed we can do this. It's wicked easy to have online learning. But the concern is that we're going to be drawing those broad conclusions, even though there's no data to back them up, just because they fit tidily into the pre-COVID, pre-established notions of the government, which is like anything that allows us to not spend money is good.
Yes. Sorry, I was just completely processing what you're saying there. Yeah, but also anything that allows us to, well, now I'm saying us, but the government to cut and save money and balance that budget, as I said earlier, was the obsession. Then that's you know, they will be happy with that, regardless of what it is. Now, something else that exists also in a shadow of austerity that has led, in my opinion, to some of the situation that we've had, and it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, because I just saw it before airtime that they're going to launch an inquiry about what has been happening in the long-term care homes under the COVID-19 situation. The problem is, at least for this government, that there is a heck of a lot of overlap between lobbyists, people that are directly involved in long-term care homes, and the party itself. So it's going to be interesting to see what goes together with, or who goes together to form this committee to do the analysis on what the problem was. But the problem began, and we've talked about this before, years ago, with cuts to long-term care, cuts to the amount of care that people can get. Many, many years ago, under the Mike Harris government, we're not in the business of doing this, we're not in the business of doing that. It becomes all private. It becomes all not temporary workers, but let's call it precarious work, agency staff, that kind of thing. We've seen that in the UK as well. There's a direct parallel between what's happened in the UK when they can't get enough staff and they get people in and they go from job to job, which is a cost, is done as a cost-saving measure because you don't have to have permanent employees. They're all, like in the UK, they call it zero-hour contracts, right? You just sort of work for a period and then you don't. We don't directly have that here, but it is similar when you have people working in multiple places. It's all a matter of chipping away at the bottom, not chipping away at the bottom line, but trying to minimize your costs and maximize your profit. And that's my 1 minute analysis of what's going on in long-term care. But it's going to be difficult for them to not show their hand, let's say, because there is so much intertwining between current government people, former government people, and it's just, that will be very interesting to watch. Now, who's to say what the level of austerity is in the homes is going to be or to continue as? That's the great question. There seems to have been a bit of leveling off, but I mean, if you look at the health department stats currently, it's, you know, the main caseload is in long-term care still. So
No, it's problematic because they came out and said it's an independent commission. It's not a public inquiry because there are very set rules about what you do for a public inquiry.
Right.
And Doug Ford, of course, is framing it as, well, it lets us be like quick and responsive. And it's like as soon as they have like some ideas and we'll start implementing them. And it's meant to be this like, I don't know. It sounds like it's a better way than a public inquiry. Of course, there's no set rules for an independent commission. They just put two words together and send it out, whereas a public inquiry has a very set group of regulations in terms of how you name the head of that inquiry, the process they go through, which would probably end up being much more complete. And then you have Christine Elliott on top of that coming out and saying, well, you know, we kind of know some of the stuff we have to do. It's like, okay, great. So you just double-tapped Doug Ford's explanation for the inquiry and for a commission instead of inquiry in its head, because you already know some of the stuff you should be doing and could theoretically start doing it. And maybe make this like a last point. Like the long-term care stuff, that's big. But in the meantime, we're already seeing like small stuff fall off the radar, or at least small in relation to COVID-19, because our own MPP Mike Schreiner has been trying to raise concerns about environmental oversight being paused in the wake of COVID-19. The government says it's so that, you know, they can be more adept at you know, getting projects going. On the other hand, you have no public oversight. You have significant projects that could be going through without notification, without public inquiries. And then Mike Schreiner gets up in the ledge and asks the Minister of Finance about it. And Jeff Urich calls Mike Schreiner, and I'm quoting, a politician in sheep's clothing.
What? When was this?
It was this week.
Oh, yeah.
During question period. So, you know, first of all, I don't know what that means.
No one knows what that means. Was like,
second of all, you know, clearly somebody's playing politics, because why would COVID-19 get in the way of environmental oversight? Because for a while there, we weren't supposed to be proceeding with any new projects at all. And it just goes to show you, you know, even we're going into the third month of the pandemic lockdown, but at the same time, you know, politics hasn't 100% gone away. And while we've been focused on the bigger stuff, there has been some under the radar stuff too that we should be concerned about. And maybe with, you know, being in stage one, maybe we can show a bit more concern about it. And one of those concerns things is that I think that the old Doug Ford government will tear off the mask of concern and look very much like the pre-pandemic Doug Ford government in the near future.
Sure. I think it's just a waiting game. You know, the moment will come with the reveal. Mm-hmm. We would have succeeded if it wasn't for you lousy kids. Anyway, speaking of inquiries, there's a lot of talk from different circles, some academic, some other places, that there should be a public inquiry for the tragic shooting in Nova Scotia, which killed, was it? It was 22 people, right? Sorry, smudge my number there. And so there was 30 professors at Dalhousie Law had an open letter to the Premier, Stephen McNeill, who said initially, and I'm not sure whether this has changed, that the province doesn't have the power to do that, which is absolute nonsense. I believe. I don't know. I'm not even sure why he would say that, because of course they have the power to do that. So, what are the two acts? Is like the Public Inquiries Act. You were talking about it a bit there. It's like there is an actual.
Yeah. And there's a Fatality Investigations Act, which.
Yes, that's right.
Sounds like it might be one of those kind of dated things. The Fatality Investigations Act. I mean, that sounds like something out of Murdoch Mysteries, but.
And it could very well have been around that long, but it's, you know, it's something that's always been with us. So that, you know, it would make total sense as to where they can do that. And they may be stalling a bit as well, I guess, because of, you know, COVID and everything else that's going on. But I mean, our question is, well, should there be an inquiry? Shouldn't it have? It's one of those things, of course, that it should go without saying that there should be an inquiry, because so much went wrong. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, already been discussed at length. There's more info coming out this week as to this, the deeper dig as to what the motivations were and the other people that were involved, and prehistory too. It would seem that the shooter had a long history of being that neighbor, but also showing off weapons. This is all alleged in documents that have come out this week. The misogynistic and domestic violence aspect of what's going on, partner violence. So it's not just it's not just the shooting alone, which in itself should prompt an inquiry, as did Ecole Polytechnique 30 years ago. But of course, the challenge that we have with public inquiries, and I think this is why some people are maybe a bit hesitant, was there was I think it might have even been as high as 400 recommendations of the Ecole Polytechnique shooting, and very, very few of them make it to law. I mean, look how long it took to get something on semi-automatic firearms and banning certain things. It took this incident and 30 years before they said, okay, we're gonna not have these anymore. So that is the pace where certain things move at. And I did read one bit about the Polytechnique study, is that it was said to have really no measurable impact. It's sometimes they can be a feel good thing. It's like, oh, okay, we had this inquiry. And to me, it's just personally, I think it's a very Canadian thing to want to have an inquiry. You see it all the time. It sort of passes for action. It's like, let's have an inquiry and we can see what happened. Of course, and of course you need to do that. You know, the police are doing the analysis of what happened. There's all sorts of angles to it, but to have the key document that says this is what happened and we need to make sure that this and this don't happen so this doesn't happen again. But you can kind of see why some people will be reticent to just say yes, do it.
Except that, I mean, there are a lot of different facets. I you know, in the case of L'École Polytechnique, it's, you know, we'd probably call him an incel now. But, you know,
yes, 100%. It'd be terrorist.
But, you know, Lapointe's rationale, you know, how, I mean, just the method of the attack. He basically went in and started shooting. And then, you know, started looking for the female students and in order to shoot them. I mean, there wasn't a lot to unpack. Except maybe there may have been some issues with the police response. I admit I haven't probably looked at that aspect of the case in a while. But in the case of what happened last month in Nova Scotia, you have, as you said, you have the domestic violence portion of this. You have the witness statements about this person's mental disposition. There was one, and this came from a cache of documents that actually the media pushed to get in court, and it was released earlier this week. It just so happened it was coincidentally around the same time you have the Dehazi profs talking about public inquiry. Mm-hmm. But, you know, so you have domestic violence, you have allegations from some witnesses that said that this person was abused in their youth, and so there may have been some deep-seated mental health issues in their own background that went below the radar. Somebody else mentioned that he went kind of crazy, to, you know, to use an inelegant word, when COVID hit and his denture clinic was closed down. You have the obsession with police and replica police cars and police uniforms and all that. You have the access to the guns, and then here's the where the premier of Nova Scotia might be especially concerned about what something would dig up. You have the public response. You have the why it took so long to get some sort of provincial alert out, the difficulties there in the communication. Did COVID have any role in that? Did staffing issues in relation to COVID have any role in that? And then this is the big thing, which is the jurisdictional part of it, that McNeil is trying to get at, that he's trying to say, well, no, this isn't Nova Scotia jurisdiction. This is federal jurisdiction because it's the RCMP. Except you have many provinces in this country where the RCMP are acting in lieu of a provincial police force. Because here in Ontario, we have the OPP, and then we have the RCMP, and they, you know, maybe there are times when their jurisdictions cross, but otherwise they have clear outlined duties. That's not so clear in places where they don't have a provincial police force. And maybe that is something that a public inquiry could get at. Not that I'm trying to say that we need more police on the streets, but was, you know, is there organizational issues? Is there training issues? What kind of issues are there with the Maritime RCMP in Nova Scotia that could have, I don't want to say that made the situation worse, because I don't think we should assign blame beyond that of the perpetrator, but in terms of anything that could have made their response better, I think that's something that you would need a public inquiry to do.
Yeah, and it is perfect storm stuff in terms of everything that was going on. COVID-19, this person that's already wound up obsessed with police, supposedly he didn't like them, but he somehow was able to get a car all tricked out in RCMP colors and uniforms. And it's one of those, it wasn't just somebody goes in and shoots and saving up massive quantities of gasoline. There's all these small things added up, but also the fact that this happened in Portapique And then the next day, so there was a pause. Somewhere this guy disappears or goes and sleeps somewhere, and then nine more people are killed the next day, including the RCMP officer, right? So we have this hole that happened in everything, and that's that too. You need to know why, like that in itself is almost a separate yet together. It's like there was this event and mass confusion, and they didn't cotton on to this guy pretending to be a cop until they found his girlfriend who he didn't kill. Is that right? Or his common law partner?
Yeah.
So there, it's tragic in that there's just so much going on, but yet with the, you know, in relation to police, as you say, is it federal jurisdiction? Is it provincial? And there's lots of overlap. And that goes way back. That goes back to like Confederation, right? Mm. If not before. But I mean, if you see pictures of the incidents, there's Halifax police, there's other police, there's other forces involved. There's what looks like a military vehicle, but it's probably just RCMP because there are times where they look, can look militaristic. And that it is for them to sort out. But there again needs to be some oversight on that. I mean, then it's also the fact that this, and I think I had said it too the day of the day after, that people were saying, oh, he's such a nice guy. It's that as well. It's another aspect to it that could be a whole other inquiry. The whole, you know, male, white, rich, dentist, supposedly a pillar in the community, but when he's at home, he's a monster. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the face of it that people don't see. So there's just so many questions. And how do you need to kind of draw all of that together and say, we need to do a deeper analysis of all aspects of this and get, you know, all everybody on board, not just the police, but other expertise from other areas, and consolidate that and say this is what needs to happen. But I would hope, because it's happened in the past too. What was that the inquiry they had about the RCMP, and they, because they didn't all necessarily have guns, wasn't the shooting in Moncton? Yes, it was in Moncton as well. I was going to say Alberta because something similar happened where RCMP kept going in, they kept getting shot, and they said they should all be issued with a sidearm, and it didn't happen. And then more RCMP were killed in similar circumstances. And, so yeah, it takes, you know, they need to, it needs to work through the system. Sadly, this is how it is. Like I'd mentioned, well, talking about Ecole Polytechnique is 30 years ago, right? So.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's Moncton was a federal inquiry, but on the other hand, that was like police were kind of explicitly targeted there, and it was police that died. And I think that again, this is a much bigger thing with so many different facets that I just don't think anything internal would do the job. And I think to shuffle it off to the feds, you know, to send it half a country away to Ottawa and say, okay, you guys look into it, that I don't think that's going to get to the bottom of what specifically happened here in the way that people want. And I think that's the point that the Dalhousie profs were trying to get at too.
Absolutely. Well, I'm sure we'll have more on that topic at a future date.
Mm-hmm.
But right now we're going to go to a break and play our usual PSAs and some information stuff and a little bit of music. You're listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM every Thursday at 5 o'clock, and we will be back momentarily. Yes, I guess we went a little bit soundtracky there, but that's just how it is. That piece is called Believe Me If All Those Endearing Young Charms, and anybody who's ever seen a Looney Tune in their life knows that song outright. And that is in honor of the fact that yesterday, May 20th, 1920, was the day that the first radio broadcast took place between Ottawa and Montreal. Supposedly the first in the world. There's some debate about that because the Americans won it first. But Canada honors that day as the first radio broadcast in this nation, at least, and possibly in the world, where Soprano came on and sang Believe Me If All Those Endearing Young Charms in Montreal, sent to Ottawa. And they played some records, too. They just, like, put them phonograph records to the microphones. And they had a gay old time, as they used to say. So that is Jenny Oakesbaker, a violinist of renown. And, yeah, so happy birthday, radio. You're 100 years old. You are there. Okay, good, Adam. I was like, where is the guy? I was like,
I didn't have anything to add.
You know, there's nothing to add to that. It's just it's good to still be on the air all these years later. I think is that station still there? CFCF Montreal? I think so.
I'll look. CFCF
Montreal was a Marconi station. Yeah, we radio nerds. Yeah, take every opportunity to say Marconi.
Yeah, it's still there. It's owned by Bell Media now.
Oh, who owned half the world? But not this station.
Yep, true enough.
So speaking of radio and media and all of that, the state of journalism during COVID-19, at the best of times, I think journalism is under attack in this day and age. We see it in cutbacks in certain departments. Before COVID even hit, there's been lots of cutbacks in newsrooms, newspapers disappearing. Over and over, we've talked about this in the past. I think we've talked about this probably from week one or so, and regarding our existence and also media in general. But the attack is full on these days, and in particular, we were talking about the Kevin Vasey. I'd never heard of this guy out on Long Island.
Well, yeah, unless you watch TV in Long Island, you probably wouldn't be familiar with Kevin Vasey.
I've watched TV in New York, but not Long Island. Yeah, so News 12 New York sent Kevin Vasey out to do some reporting, and he's a fairly well-known person in the area. And it was to cover a pro-Trump protest, like, or not just pro-Trump, but to open up the restrictions and the usual we've seen the Yahoos, as Doug Ford called them. And they literally went after this guy. I mean, that one bit was kind of frightening where the guy was coming after him. He's like, get back. Supposedly this reporter had COVID, but he still doesn't want anybody in his face. Obviously, this guy's coming at him. It's okay. I'm on hydroxychloroquine. It's just it's just like this. So there was this, you know, the B-reel of the whole incident. And then, of course, there was an edited version got out there. But this guy was literally under attack. And almost every – and you watched it too, Adam. Of course, every person that he wanted to get a comment from said, you're fake news. Like, it's just – they're just parroting Trump talking points, right? There's no real originality there. And it's as if Trump's attacks have moved just from beyond the White House garden there, where he's – all over people, to just people on the street. Now you can't just go with a microphone and ask a question. And considering the times too, like it is dangerous to do that in the pandemic. But now it's like there's no fear there. People are just willing to attack this guy who seems to be just doing his job. He's like, so how do you feel? You know that. So how do you feel? Which is the standard. So,
well, it's worth pointing out he was there covering them. Right, that there's this, you know, lineup, a small group of people lined up along the roadway in this town of Long Island, and he's there doing the reporter's job, which is like, who are you? Why are you here? And the reaction was, you know, things to the effect of, you know, like, tell the truth, Kevin, and F you, and as the guy said, he's like, oh, don't worry about me, bro, I'm on chloroquine, and it's like. And somebody made the point, I think it was somebody from one of the newsletters I get. I can't remember. I read so many freaking newsletters every day. But,
and you make one, too.
But he made the point, like, you know, when you're protesting something, you want to get attention. That's the point of the protest. And you have Kevin Vasey going out and saying, I'm covering your protest. And the response is like, no, you get out of here. We don't want to deal with you. And basically him, like, understandably feeling threatened by it all. And it's like, not only are you making it that much harder to get, I mean, their message is stupid on the face of it, but not only are you making it harder to get your message out there, but everyone else who might have a message, who might be doing a protest to fight for something they believe in, whether that's climate change, whether that's, you know, better autism funding, whether that's better treatment for indigenous people. I'm just naming off the protests I've
sure
covered, but, you know, you're making it that much harder because you're basically saying to the press, no, we're here to raise attention, but not from you, not from quote-unquote fake news. And, you know, so it just doesn't make that much, it doesn't make sense on that base of it, because of course the whole point of having a protest is to get attention, and then when you get attention, it's the worst possible attention by treating the person covering you as horribly as possible. And then maybe bring this to a local level. I mean, we have a local TV station out of Kitchener. Like, imagine if, you know, somebody was protesting down in front of Market Squared, and who's a reporter from CTV? Max Wark or Alex Pinto show up, and they're like, "You're fake news! Get out of here! We hate you!" It's like, you would feel silly, and that's the thing you got to feel about this Kevin Vasey situation. It's like, here he is, just the regular run of the mill, down the middle,
local
TV local newser, and people are treating him like, I don't know, like he's
dirt.
Yeah, sure, why not?
I think that's an Americanism. I don't treat him like dirt. But supposedly the people that organized this protest under their First Amendment rights, and again, that's another American aspect, like, First Amendment! They'll just yell First Amendment.
Yeah.
The Setauket Patriots apologized to Kevin Vasey, and he did an interview with one of the Patriots.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like the majority of the people there, or at least this guy was trying to say, the majority of the people there were peaceful. But having said that, I mean, that county out in Long Island has one of the highest infection rates in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And we can see why when you have these protests and gatherings. Now, some people have masks on, but they do not care. And if you have enough of a chunk of people that don't care, it's going to happen. Now, and to go to a Canadian example as well, one of the protests, I believe it was one of the ones at Queen's Park, there was a moment, and I'm not sure if you saw it, where it was Rebel News versus CBC. I can't remember the CBC reporter's name, but there was this chanting going off in the distance like, CBC sucks or something. And the guy with Rebel News said to the CBC reporter, he said, why do you think they're booing CBC? And of course, without missing a beat, she said, why don't you go ask them? Which is what a journalist is supposed to do. Like, why are you asking me? I'm just covering this. So you go ask them why they're... And he probably did, but, you know, try not to pay any heed to Rebel. But it was a pretty funny moment. But it's a reflection of, you know, the Canadian version of these things is always just sort of a minor point, whereas in the U.S. it's like, you know, multiply times 10 the amount of vitriol that's going on in these people's minds. You know, if Trump says it's fake news, then everything is fake news. I mean, did Trump go after Fox? I saw a bit where it was like, Trump was like upset with Fox as well, which is like his station. Yeah. I mean, that's his mouthpiece, right? They're the quasi unofficial mouthpiece of the White House and all things Trump, right?
I think it was one of the anchors had a rare moment of holy crapism when Trump admitted he was taking hydroxychloroquine and basically was trying to explain why you shouldn't do that, Fox News viewer. And I mean, there are times when, whether it's Shep Smith, whether it's Chris Wallace, I think it was Neil Baer who got Trump's ire this time. There are times when Trump gets mad at the closer to real news people at Fox News, not the Laura Ingrams or the Sean Hannitys, like the real cheerleaders who come on in prime time, but like the people who can still be generously called news reporters. The fact that Fox News still kind of employs a few of them does occasionally irk Donald Trump.
And, you know, the bottom line in the States, like I said off the top there, is that there were, I think it was last week, the New York Times estimated that there's been 36,000 media people laid off, furloughed, or their pay reduced in the wake of COVID-19. And like I said, we've seen it in the States and Canada as well. Was Post Media in the middle of all this, right? You're going to take salary reductions, close the papers, Bell Media, sports. I think all the sports departments just got the axe like right away because there's no, you know, there's no hope for them. There's no sports. What are you going to cover? I saw that one. There was that one golf game on the weekend, in which no one was keeping their 2 meters. But that's another story. But yeah, it's the news is right now is a bad news story. Jobs that were already on the way are gone, and yet there are still the people out there with a microphone on the stick and the mask, just trying really, really hard to get the story. But
right, and I think an important thing to point out here is that news has not been the greatest, and you know, we saw that a couple of weeks ago when the whole murder hornets thing broke. All of a sudden, we were talking about murder hornets,
and there was but it's like killer bees, murder hornets,
right? And there was no context about murder hornets at all, because you know, you do a couple of minutes of reading, and you can find out that actually murder hornets aren't terribly rare, or are not terribly, or they are terribly rare. That there's virtually no chance of them harming humans. And it's kind of more of a curiosity than it is like a pestilence that's coming to kill us. But the thing of it is, in the news, yeah, well, in the news culture we have, you're flipping through, you know, Facebook or Twitter or wherever you get your news, like your Apple News app or whatever, you just see murder hornets and it jumps out at you. And when, whether that's killer bees, as you said, or murder hornets, or Y2K, or you know, Tide Pod Challenge, these like minuscule things get incredibly inflated in the media atmosphere. And when that happens enough times, it becomes a situation of the boy or girl who cried wolf. And so I feel that we in the news media have at times not done our jobs to the best of our abilities in terms of giving people the straight facts and, frankly, the boring version of the news in favor of what's salacious, in favor of what's over the top, in favor of what sounds silly, like murder hornets. And that desensitizes people. And I think that all these anti-lockdown protests and yelling fake news at people is kind of a symptom of that. And in so much as we need people to support their local news, I think it behooves us to keep in mind that as an industry, we should always be striving to do better too.
Yeah, the media truck should just take a portable 5G tower with them and stick it up, and then you know that'll quiet them down. Or a murder hornet nest, just keep it handy. Like, oh, there they come.
Oh my goodness.
So I was there. Really is no segue. I was going to say, speaking of murder hornets, but possibly social murder. In my opinion, Amazon may have the first trillionaire at the helm. Jeff Bezos is raking it in, even in the middle of the pandemic. Now, if I understand it right, the trillionaire title wouldn't be like next week or anything. It's like if current conditions continue and he keeps making $1 billion every 5 minutes or something, that he will quite possibly be the world's first trillionaire. And of course, as we know, at least in my opinion, the world needs no trillionaires, let alone billionaires, but that's not
right.
My call to make, I guess. But
the math is very, very loose, and it got reported in a lot of different quarters as sort of like it's going to happen. And when you dig deeper into it, basically it came from an analyst site called Comparison that said like by 2026, and they did like the very simple math that, you know, Amazon or Jeff Bezos, who's the founder and CEO of Amazon, his net worth has increased by 34% every year in the last 5 years. And if that stays exactly the same as it has, then by 2026, he could be the world's first trillionaire. Other analysts are saying, well, it seems kind of unlikely that he would for another 6 years, he would have that kind of growth. But on the other hand, a lot of other analysts are remarking that, you know, if there's kind of one business that is going to survive COVID-19 and maybe even a better position than going in, it would be Amazon.
Oh, for sure. Because, I mean, with every – you keep hearing about the death – things that have died in the retail markets, like JCPenney's an example, and others in the States and in Canada that Victoria's Secret? I saw that before airtime. It's on CBC there that it's just going to be gone. With every large or small business that close up like that, but mostly the large ones that involve certain retail setting beyond the Walmarts of the world, that's more business for Amazon. And a lot of this bump he's seen, I think, is totally due to COVID, because people are just getting things shipped to their homes. It's not that no one is going out, but the degree, well, I'll just get it from Amazon, which is, it was trending. It was what people were starting to do anyway. Now, there's probably a ton of people ordering things from Amazon now that never even dreamed that they would be doing that. So that this is where the billions are coming from. But does that trickle down to the people that work there? And it would seem like it hasn't. It did for a brief period of time. The appreciation pay that the workers were getting there is, they're not, what did the PR person said? He's like, well, we're not cutting it. It's just coming to an end. It's right, like, yeah, yeah, it's you know, that's a fine line there, son. You know, it's, assuming, sorry, I'm not even sure whether it was a man that said that. I take that back. But yeah, considering Bezos can give, well, not give, the settlement to his ex-wife was $38 billion, and he's still got the billions raking it in. I don't know if he did make a comment about the money that has been spent in the warehouses on COVID-19 provisions, supposedly. I've heard everything from $800 million to, I think he said $4 billion by the end of it will be spent on COVID measures. But I don't know that can be happening, because all you hear out of the state, if you just Google Amazon COVID, there will be something comes up every day or a couple of days about the warehouse in an area, like a place that you may or may not have heard of. One was, what's Kenosha? What show was that? It's the only reason I know where Kenosha is. 70 show.
70 show, yeah.
Yeah. It's like, oh, Kenosha's got cases and somebody has died. But the setup in these plants is the same as, you know, your average meat packing plant or whatever. It's probably impossible to keep distances. There's stuff comes in from all over the world and goes out to all over the world, or at least all over the country that they're situated in. But it sounds like the workers got a T-shirt, a thank you T-shirt. So for all the work, got a T-shirt that said, thanks to you, together we will deliver. Yay. But no, unlike the unlimited unpaid time off. And this is a sticking point as well. It's like through the peak of COVID, at least this peak of COVID, because we're going to see more in the future, I believe. Anyway, I hope not. But anyway, that's a whole other story. They were allowed to take unpaid time off longer than they would normally, but that's been revoked as well. So it's like all of these things that are supposed to alleviate the problems they've been having, maybe taking care of your kids, or you've got COVID and you're coming to work. Like, were they going to ask you, like, just please come in. We need you. Well, I can't. I've got this. No, just come, because we have things to ship. Do you want somebody sending stuff to your house that may or may not have COVID? Like, it's mind blowing.
Well, no matter how much money they've sort of spent in the meantime, you know, Amazon was incredibly slow off the mark. And you go back to the beginning of April, and there were stories of, like, various people coming forward talking about how one that stuck out to me was in Wired, where you had one person who worked at a warehouse in California saying that, you know, they have to come in. When they come into the warehouse every day, they come in, they have to enter through a turnstile, which everybody touches but is never cleaned. And you know, just anecdotal stuff like that. The speed at which they have to process orders too, is just, you know, remarkable. And there's a lot of reporting about that before the start of the pandemic, just how much pressure people in those fulfillment centers are under. And then on top of that, now I think we've had 7 people at various Amazon warehouses who have passed away from COVID-19. It's been 6 or 7. I'm not sure about the 7th, but I definitely know there's been 6. And, you know, and I think what makes the story juicy is people have understandable, I don't want to say hate the rich, but I mean, they have understandable apathy towards the plight of rich people, Jeff Bezos being the richest of all. He still has $144 billion. That's his net worth. And then for him to, you know, the pandemic is far from over, for his business to say, oh, okay, you know, danger's past, we're going to take back that pay, it automatically rubs people the wrong way, because it took so much to get that attention in the first place, to get that extra pay. And I think in terms of the bigger issue, just as Walmart kind of set the tone for how employees were treated, how they were compensated, and how their business was run in the late 90s, early 2000s, that's where Amazon is now. So when the big cat like Amazon makes decisions like, we're going to end your emergency pay, we're going to end your emergency leaves, that's going to have a trickle-down effect too, because Amazon's not the only business that has instituted those policies. There are a lot of grocery stores who have increased the minimum wage or increased the wages that their people get because they're essential workers. And so if Amazon's taking the initiative now, while the COVID, while the pandemic is still maybe not peaking, but certainly plateauing, it's certainly not going away in many places in North America, what's everybody else going to do? You know, all these poor people who work their butts off through this pandemic to keep basically keep the economy going, are they going to basically just, you know, at the end of June or the end of summer, you know, they're just going to say, okay, great, thanks, everyone. Thanks for working your tail off. Now it's back to $14 an hour for you and no benefits. Yeah, I don't think that's fair.
And it also sounds like anybody, I think there was a couple of cases in California where anybody that's remotely involved in labor organizing, a whiff of it, if you go to the cameras and say, this sucks, I'm obviously paraphrasing, and they know who you are, they will just fire you. So it's classics. This is like going back to, it's going back 100 years to when radio was new, right? It's like, no, seriously though, it's like, that old dynamic between the, you know, the big boss, the Rockefeller or the Carnegie in the office, and presumably trickling on down to the workers, but it's just not happening. And people would probably financial types respect Bezos types because, oh, look at all this money that he's made. But if you can't protect your workers, and it's not just people getting sick, there are people dying. So if there's people dying in your business and you accept that as the cost of doing business, then like that without spending this, I almost swore, this ton of money, this Scrooge McDuck pile of money that you have to not safeguard people, you're saying that their lives are worthless. That is what you are saying to the people that make you the multi-billionaire, maybe to be a trillionaire, you are saying that they are garbage. It's like, get back to work. The essential term too. I had heard that I'm not sure if it was just a franchise or an area of McDonald's in the States. Mm. All they were given was a badge, a button that said essential on it. They weren't given any raise. They weren't given like an extra Big Mac or whatever they get. It was like, here's, you're essential. And they just keep throwing that term around. And I don't know. There are people that will feel good because they've been magically deemed essential. It's like you weren't essential until this minute, and now you're not really essential. If they're saying it to make you feel better, it's like, oh, by the way, if you have, this is another concern too with people going to order fulfillment on Amazon in the States, anybody with a pre-existing health condition is terrified to go to work, but they have to go. Right, they can't get time off. It's like, well, I have kidney disease, but I have to be here because I need to. I've never heard anybody talking about their health complaints and saying they were essential. It's like, well, I have to be there, or we are going to starve. So it's again, it's going back to this something that we thought we'd left in the past with this the arrangement. Like I said, I called it social murder. I think that's Engels. I think I'm unconsciously quoting Engels there, saying, well, he wrote the book on it. As a son of a factory owner, right? It's like he said, people just work. You work till you die, and this is what's being expected of them. And of course,
right. And the thing of it is that people have been made to believe that's the way things should be, and that having a job, no matter how bad you are treated at that job, no matter how crappy your pay is at that job, the point is you have a job, and you should be bloody well grateful. And that if you want anything more, you're a muckraker and an S disturber, and you're going to get everybody fired because how dare you want a living wage or something like that.
Well, here's to the muckrakers and the S disturbers. And on that note, we'll have to call it a day, Adam. It just goes so fast, really.
I know.
Even this remote thing, like I'm nodding my head at an empty chair that I set up just so I could, you know, nod my head and pretend. And maybe I'll shuffle a mannequin into the bunker next time and put some glass on it and call it the Donaldson. Like, that was a soccer game in Korea where they just got like dolls to fill the stadium. I'm not going to go that far, but anyway, it was good to talk to you. I feel like I'm bringing the meeting to an end as well. It's I guess it is sort of in a way. You have been listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM. My name is Scotty Hertz. You can find me at Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter, and at scottyhertz@bell.net if you're old school. And Adam, where can people find you?
I am at Adam A. Donaldson on Twitter and Instagram, and you can find my news and politics site at guelphpolitico.ca.
My goodness, still not used to this role reversal thing, but we'll get there. By the time I get it ironed out, we'll be back in here, right? I hope so.
Hopefully.
Anyway, take care, folks. Same time next week, 5 o'clock for Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU, and enjoy your week.